The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
Yeah, failure is inevitable if you're doing something complicated. It's not that it's a good thing, it's just, you know, you're going to have it. So you might as well respond to it in a sensible way.
The economist and author Tim Harford questions some of our assumptions about certainty and leadership when it comes to doing good science. He tells us why we need to fail small to win big. And...
Seminal fluid, of course, always goes down well at parties, so to speak.
A comedy night for geeks. We head to the Bright Club to test out the theory that scientists can provide some serious giggles. And not just for laughs, The Guardian's Ian Sample and Nell Bowes discuss this week's big science news, including how cities can affect your brain and how bugs are getting in on the drugs trade. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Regular listeners to Science Weekly will be aware that week in and week out, we bring you interviews with the most authoritative figures in the science community. These are the people with the big ideas and the emphatic belief that their research and inventions can change the world, which all means that we're guilty of creating the bubble that our next guest is intent on bursting. Tim Harford is a leading writer on economics and the author of a new book called Adapt. Using ideas drawn from evolutionary biology, physics, and psychology, he sets out why in science and in economics, many of our assured positions and great plans really add up to very little. In fact, chance and luck play a big role in discovery and progress. And I'm delighted to say that Tim joins me in the studio now. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Nice
now,
to be here.
Let's start by asking you something which seems odd. How does this sort of success or failure of a company depend on Darwin's theory of natural selection?
So let's look at the superficial similarities. Superficial similarity, and this is something that economics textbooks don't really reflect very well, is that there are a lot of corporate failures. Corporations die out all the time. Well, they don't die, they go bankrupt or they get bought out. But about 10% of American companies go bankrupt or otherwise disappear every year. So that's a sort of superficial similarity. And you would say, well, you could say, well, it's survival of the fittest. The companies that are good at supplying products that customers want to buy or are somehow tricked into buying, they make them at a cost below what the customers are willing to pay. Those are the companies that succeed, and companies that don't do that will go bankrupt. So now we're getting more and more towards evolution, but actually there are some deeper parallels. So the economist Paul Ormerod, who's a fascinating guy, he loves beating up other economists with their own favorite weapon, which is mathematics. Ormerod's looked at the deeper patterns of extinction events. If you look at extinction events in biological evolution over the last 500 million years, what you see is a power law. There'll be a few extreme extinction events. They're very rare. And it's more common to have fairly bad extinction events. And then it's very common to have almost no extinctions at all, or just an underlying sort of background radiation of extinctions. If you look at disappearances of firms, say the largest 100 firms a century ago, what's happened to them? You get the same power law. There was one year, 1968, I think, where six of them disappeared all in one year. But most years, none of them disappear. Then you look at smaller firms, you get the same pattern. You look internationally, you get the same pattern. So there's actually this quite deep parallel between the patterns of extinctions in the economy and the patterns of extinctions in biology. And what Ormerod argues, and I think he's probably right, is that this reflects the fact that actually a lot of economic success is fairly random.
How does this apply to the way that scientists work? Because many scientists will probably think of themselves as experimenters.
Well, it does very much. I have a chapter on innovation in general. And one of the things that you notice when you start to look at this is a lot of long shots with potentially very, very high payoffs. It could be a financial payoff, or it could be a social payoff, or a payoff in terms of how much we know about the world. The first example I give in the book is the Spitfire. This amazing fighter plane during World War II, which was basically, if you think about Plan A, Plan B, the Spitfire was roughly Plan Q. I mean, it was way down the list of priorities. Winston Churchill campaigned against it. It was trying to do something that most people thought was impossible, and it was trying to do it in a way that people thought, even if it even if it was possible, this isn't the way to do it. I mean, there were so many reasons why the Spitfire should never have been built. But a bureaucrat in the Air Ministry, a guy called Air Commodore Henry Cave Brown Cave, I just imagine this guy with his big twirly moustache, nicely waxed.
He insists on everyone using his full name.
I hope so. I really hope so. So Air Commodore Henry Cave Brown Cave saw this baffling prototype for the Spitfire with every reason to believe it wouldn't work and said, why not? The quote is, it will be a most interesting experiment. And Cave Brown Cave's approval of that project cost £10,000, which is about the price of a nice house in central London at the time. Not a lot of money. Maybe a million in today's money, half a million in today's money. And what did it do? Well, it basically prevented a Nazi invasion of Britain, saved the lives of 450,000 Jews, allowed the Manhattan Project to continue because most of the scientists who eventually participated in the Manhattan Project were in Britain at the time. I mean, it was a really hugely important innovation. And there are many, many examples of that. So when you start to think about trial and error in that kind of system, what you want is a funding mechanism, wherever the money's coming from, that's very, very tolerant of lots and lots and lots of low-cost failures, because the successes are going to be really important.
Now, this is an interesting sort of nice dovetail into science funding, because you've got a very interesting example of a funding decision which didn't get quite as expected.
This was when a scientist called Mario Capecchi applied to the National Institutes for Health in the US, the early 1980s. Now, the NIH is this huge taxpayer-funded body that funds medical research. And because they're spending taxpayers' money, they're quite conservative about it. They want you to prove that you're going to get some results. And Capecchi had some funding requests that were very conservative and satisfied the NIH's procedures. But he also had this idea that sounded like science fiction. And the NIH said, under no circumstances should you try to do this with the money that we're going to give you. It was an idea to try to knock out a gene inside a mouse and replace it with another gene. So this is the equivalent of replacing a paragraph of a book in a whole library and doing so at a molecular level. So you're going to need more than a magnifying glass and tweezers to do this. And remember, we're talking 30 years ago. So Capecchi gets this ultimatum from the NIH. Here's the money. Don't do that crazy thing. Now, if you understand where Capecchi was coming from, his first memory is of his mother being taken away to a concentration camp. His father was brutal, beat him. He ran away at the age of 4 during World War II, was a street urchin for years, in and out of orphanages and hospitals, and on his 9th birthday was collected from a hospital by a woman he didn't recognize, which was his mother, and she was unrecognizable because she'd spent so long in Dachau. She took him to the States. He's a feral Italian kid. He doesn't speak any English. He hasn't had any education his entire life. He's 9 years old, and somehow he ends up at Harvard. At Harvard, he's working under James Watson. And James Watson, he asked Watson, where should I study molecular biology? And Watson says, well, you should study it here at Harvard. You'd be effing crazy to study anywhere else, except Watson didn't say effing. And Capecchi decided, after a couple of years under Watson, which were very successful, that Harvard was just, the phrase he used was, it was a bastion of short-term gratification. A bastion of short-term gratification. In other words, too many smart people trying to impress too many other smart people in a hurry. Okay, so Capecchi then goes and sets up his own department in the University of Utah, which just couldn't be more isolated because he wants to do great things and he needs to protect himself from all of these outside influences. And he'll go to conferences, of course, but he just doesn't want all this pressure. So given all this history, when the NIH give him this ultimatum, Capecchi obviously takes the money and spends it exactly the way he wants, knocks the gene out of this mouse, replaces it with another gene, goes back to the NIH for approval of a further stream of funding, and the NIH sort of they have this letter and that we're very glad you didn't take our advice. Shamefaced, and he of course won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2007. So the point of this whole story is we seem to be selecting in science for incredibly stubborn people, and wouldn't it be nice if we were able to cut creative, original scientists a little bit more slack. The interesting thing about this is There's a study now been done by three economists. I'm an economist, I'm not a scientist. I'm interested in the economics of this. So these three economists have studied NIH funding compared with much more experimental funding stream available from a private foundation called the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which was originally a tax dodge and now it isn't. And it funds people like Capecchi to do more radical experimental research. And they emphasize, you know, even if there's a high probability of failure. And the NIH, because it's spending our tax dollars, our tax pounds, doesn't want to risk failure. You look at the results, comparing like with like, similar scientists with very similar track records. When they get NIH funding, government funding, they will produce peer-reviewed research. The success rate is very, very high. And in that respect, it does work. And you're doing all kinds of important work, replication, all the kind of stuff that makes science tick. But you do need that more experimental HHMI funding. Because if your definition of success is not something in a peer-reviewed journal, but one of the top 1% of most cited journal articles, or prizes won, or new keywords introduced to the literature, you know, we've founded a whole new subset of science, then HHMI grants, the more experimental grants, are much better.
There is a little coda to that story, isn't there? Just in case any Brits are feeling like, well, the British Research Councils wouldn't do something like this.
Well, yes, they turned down Martin Evans to do pretty much the same research at pretty much the same time. In the end, Martin Evans shared the Nobel Prize with Capecchi. But I mean, I guess one lesson is pluralism is great. I mean, there is a value in having different research councils in different countries, because what one research council may turn down, somebody else will do somewhere. And of course, the whole world benefits in the end.
One of the elements of your book, and what I suppose you're trying to get across to politicians, social scientists, everyone, is that there are implications in policy for a lot of what you're talking about, in that failure is not necessarily a terrible thing. Sometimes it's part of becoming successful. I mean, that's the sort of tagline of your book.
Well, failure is inevitable if you're doing something complicated. It's not that it's a good thing. It's just, you know, you're going to have it. So you might as well respond to it in a sensible way.
Now, I mean, let me play the devil's advocate for a second as well. I mean, we talked about failure being inevitable, and you sold me on that. But my question is, sometimes failure is quite catastrophic. You can't have failure in lots of times in when you're experimenting on, I don't know, building nuclear power stations, for example. Where does the line draw, and when is failure not really an option?
So I looked at really complex and dangerous systems such as nuclear power and, of course, finance. And the parallels are fascinating. So these are what the sociologist Charles Perrow calls complex, tightly coupled systems. Most of what I'm writing about in the book are complex systems, but they're not tightly coupled. Tightly coupled is like domino toppling. You know, you knock the first domino over and they all go. And that makes it very hard to experiment, because things happen too quickly and consequences are very unpredictable. So the people I talked to when trying to understand these systems were safety engineers. I spoke to Charles Perrow, who is the sociologist who studied nuclear accidents and industrial accidents. I studied Piper Alpha, Three Mile Island. I spoke to James Reason, who's a psychologist who studies human error. And all of these people said, you know, this is the way to understand the financial crisis. We've actually got something here that the bankers and the banking regulators should be using. So a couple of quick insights. One is safety systems often backfire, partly because they make people more careless, and partly because they make the system more complex in sort of unnecessary ways. And there were financial safety systems, the credit default swaps and the collateralized debt obligations that Robert Peston sort of jumps up and down on TV talking about. They're effectively financial safety systems that had really perverse outcomes. So that's one lesson. A second lesson is whistleblowers are really important. Whether you're talking about an industrial accident or a financial accident, by the use of the word accident, I don't mean it's nobody's fault, but I just mean people did things and the consequences were much worse than they might have expected. In both cases, there are people who see what's going on, who understand what's going on, and who are trying to speak up about it, and we tend to treat them very badly. And the third thing, and this ties into what George Osborne's been talking about and what the Vickers Commission have been talking about, is it can be very powerful to try to simplify and what you might call decouple the system, try and separate parts of the system from other parts of the system, so that if something fails, the whole system doesn't fail simultaneously. You can actually isolate the failures and keep them small. And this is a principle that engineers try to follow, but it's a principle we should also be trying to follow as we restructure banks.
Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. We'll be right back.
Big thanks to Tim Harford there. For more information on his book, Adapt, published by Little Brown, and Tim's other activities, visit his website. That's timharford.com. With me in the studio now to discuss this week's science news are The Guardian's Nell Bowes and Ian Sample. Welcome to you both.
Hello. Hello.
Ian, we're going to start off with your story this week about what the UK government was doing to prepare for the Fukushima crisis. Now, what were they doing in terms of planning, given that it was half a world away?
Well, how this came about was I was trying to find out throughout the early stages of the Fukushima crisis what the UK based its worst case scenario on. So here we had a very unstable situation. As you say, the other side of the world, it was a nuclear power plant that had at least three reactors that were sort of in operation when the earthquake struck. So they were unstable. You had a load of storage pools with spent fuel in. They were unstable as well. And there was a lot of very shaky information. So I was just trying to find out how did the UK work out what the worst could be, because there are British people over there and all the rest of it. And despite asking for all this information and so on, it wasn't forthcoming. So I put in a Freedom of Information Act request and got all of the papers. So the papers I got back were really all of the documents that were prepared by the various advisors to government for the chief scientist, Sir John Beddington, and who's the chair of the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies. So these were groups like the Health Protection Agency, the National Nuclear Lab, the guys who monitor radiation clouds, which is actually run out of DEFRA and places like the Met Office, and just combined efforts to work out the worst case scenario.
So they were very much looking at what would happen if it went off the charts and we had to deal with people coming off planes who had been in the who'd come off the planes from Japan, who'd been in the location of Fukushima. How apocalyptic did they get?
Well, so basically they had what I would regard as a pretty good worst-case scenario, and they call it a reasonable worst-case scenario. So this is pretty much everything that could go wrong apart from bringing Godzilla into the equation. So they had basically the reactors. You have something happen where you have a major release that stops you getting to the rest of the plant, essentially. So that means that eventually you have meltdowns in three reactors. The sort of molten fuel burns through the bottom of the pressure vessels. You get an explosion, releases a lot of radiation. So you get about 10% of the reactor core released from those three reactors. And you also get a lot of radiation coming off all six ponds. And when you tot all this up, they were then saying, okay, you get this huge, in one go essentially, this huge release of radiation that then would be create a plume that would, under their scenario, blow steadily towards Tokyo in a kind of beeline with no rain until you reach Tokyo. So this is like absolutely the worst. A lot of things have got to go wrong for this to happen. It's why it's a worst-case scenario. But the amount of radiation that they calculated would have come off, when you work it through, as I did, it comes out to be about twice as much that was released from Chernobyl. Now, that sounds quite dramatic, and I guess it is, but you have to bear in mind this wasn't ever expected actually to be as bad as Chernobyl, because in Chernobyl the problems were because, first of all, you had this big graphite fire in the core that thrust all the radiation cloud up and high up into the atmosphere, so it went everywhere. More immediately, the problem really was you didn't clear people out, you didn't evacuate people, and you didn't stop them eating contaminated produce.
Now, how much did the UK authorities actually know about what was going on in Fukushima? You mentioned that it was an evolving thing over many weeks. How much did the authorities know exactly about the details of what was happening?
Well, some of these documents are really interesting because they cite the sources that they were getting their information from. And I noticed on their PowerPoint presentation from 2010 that TEPCO, the Japanese company that runs Fukushima, they had a PowerPoint presentation online, which I had looked at myself. I'd found it and I was trying to work out from that PowerPoint presentation how much stuff was on the site. And it had fed into their own estimations as well. But the problem they were having, they were pulling information from left, right, and center. They were using Google Translation to try and understand some Japanese documents. They were getting the National Nuclear Laboratory to come up with questions like, if you get a molten blob dropping through a reactor, how high will the plume go? The response came back, we don't know. We don't have the expertise. We don't think it'll be as high as Chernobyl. But the answer is, we don't know. And they were also the guys who said the government were asking, what happens if you get one event? Is there a danger of a domino effect, which means one goes, you can't get to the rest, so they all go as well? And the answer came back, yes, that's likely. And so it was early on, you can chart the questions through the days and weeks, and it gets more and more specific as different risk issues come more to the fore. But in the early stages, it really was just a broad brush. What on earth is going on? What is on the site? What are the dangers? You know, let's work out what can go wrong here.
What's the state of Fukushima today?
At the moment, they are in this painful, I suppose it's all been painful, but this painful long tail of getting the plant stable. They still have an extraordinary amount of contaminated water, radioactive material contaminated water on the site, which makes it really hard to get to actually work on the nuts and bolts of the problems, to try and really go inside any of those reactor buildings and get any of that done. It's only robots that have been inside there doing a lot of that stuff because it's too hot, it's too radioactive to go in and do any decent work. So at the moment, you're still cooling, they're still pumping water in, and this is going to go on for months. I mean, a couple of months ago, they released their game plan, to a long-term plan for getting this stable. It goes on for at least 6 months, and then you have, that's just getting the reactors safe. That's just bringing the reactors down to a cool temperature and making sure all the spent fuel is safe. You still then have to work out what to do with the thing, because at the end of the day, this site is condemned. It's not going to be a functioning nuclear plant ever again, or functioning anything ever again. It's going to be just mothballed. So this is going to go on for months and years.
Okay, well, let's move on from that to the dangers of living in cities. Now, all of us around this table live in cities, and most of our listeners probably live in cities. More than 70% of people will be living in cities by the middle of this century. And I think that last year or the year before, more than half of the entire world's population was living in urban areas. So it's an interesting study that was published in Nature last week, looking at the mental health of people who live in cities. Now, previously, it has been shown that those people who live in urban areas have a 21% increased risk of anxiety disorders and a 39% increase in mood disorders. And apparently, your incidence of developing schizophrenia is twice as high in cities, in people born and brought up in cities, as compared to those born and brought up in the countryside. And so the researchers who published in Nature last week were trying to work out what it was about the brains of people living in cities that was different. Now, they scanned 50 healthy volunteers, and these people given arithmetic to do, whilst being told they were not performing very well. And
idea of this stress test.
Well, this stress test has been developed. Basically, what it means is that there's two types. They did two experiments, actually. One of which was it's quite fun, where they were in an fMRI scanner, and they had to do these mental arithmetic tests, which got harder and harder, whilst the researchers would phone them up in the middle saying, "You're not doing very well. Stop. This experiment's very, very expensive. You've got to try and work harder." And these people, it was completely uncorrelated with how they were performing. Another one where there was actually a video camera in front of, a video screen in front of them, with two scientists in lab coats looking at them and shaking their heads the whole time. Apparently, this really stresses people. Yeah, no, it's true. Anyway, so what they wanted to do with that was look at the brain under stress. So there were two parts of the brain which they noticed were hyperactive in people who'd either been brought up in or were living in cities. The first was the amygdala. Now, the amygdala is a sort of primal part of the brain that deals with emotion and stress and anxiety and that kind of thing. And this was the part that was lit up in people who were currently living in cities. And another region called the cingulate cortex was lit up in people who were born in cities. And if you were born and brought up and you're still living in one, both of them were lit up. So it was quite sort of interesting that basically that these researchers could pinpoint bits of the brain that specifically work differently if you live in cities.
Do we know the mechanism? Why do people living in cities react differently in stressful situations?
Well, this is something they couldn't measure in the study itself, but they do speculate. So the researchers at University of Heidelberg, who measured all of this, said that it's possible that living in cities has some sort of priming effect on these parts of the brain. So not only when you're stressed do you see these bits becoming hyperactive, but as you live in cities or are born in one, certain stresses around you, whether it's overcrowding perhaps or not getting enough nutrients and light or something, could be affecting those parts of the brain and essentially priming them to then react in a sort of overactive way. They don't know what those things are. And They would have to test in kind of quite interesting studies following this to actually pinpoint those sorts of things.
So what's the answer? Should we all move to the countryside?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know how you feel about the countryside. It's lovely to go to, but I always hanker back to come back to the city. No, well, it's interesting. There's a News and Views article published in Nature at the same time last week. And they pose this question. Are people in the countryside happier? Well, it turns out they're not necessarily, because suicide rates in the countryside are much higher than they are in the city. Plus, in the city, you might have these problems, but you've also got lots of stimulating things going on. It can be cosmopolitan. There's all sorts of cultural things going on. So it's kind of one and the other, really, about how you sort of take it. But what the researchers thought in getting these findings, what they thought would be interesting is, how would you use this stuff to design cities better so you wouldn't have these latent effects sitting in your brain? For example, one of the things that they suggested was perhaps it's about overcrowding. Some research has shown that if someone invades your personal space, it can actually cause you lots of stress and lasting stress damage. I don't know who these people are, but apparently it can cause...
So do they need to research rich people versus poor people in cities?
Well, so this is the question. So if you're overcrowded, maybe that's causing your brain to have some sort of latent problem or something. So you would then try to work out whether living next to parks is a good idea. So perhaps if you're just less crowded, then you're happier. Or maybe it's just looking at green things and being next to parks. And these are the examples I was given. Maybe that's it. But they really just don't know at this stage what it is. But I don't think that I'm going to be moving out of the city anytime soon. I don't know about you lot. Talking of brains and trips away from the city, Ian, you wrote an interesting blog post last week, which is at the cutting edge of synthetic biology. It's about getting yeast to make illicit drugs, LSD specifically. Why would you want to make LSD with yeast?
Well, let's be fair. It was a study out of Harvard University, where this guy who was just finished his PhD there, synthetic biologist, was looking at making lysergic acid. So lysergic acid is the... You're most of the way there to making LSD if you're making lysergic acid. LSD is just a diethyl amide of lysergic acid.
Yeah, pretty I knew that, yeah.
Simple change to make.
I love those diethyl amides.
But it came about by this guy worked in a lab where they were using synthetic biology, where you're just using a lot of molecular techniques to try and design sort of biology to do things that what you want to do basically as an engineering tool. He was at a lab where they were using these kinds of techniques to try and create yeast and other bugs that can churn out molecules that will end up being biofuels. And they would have these occasional meetings with venture capitalists that would come by, and they would just basically shake their heads and say, look, fuel's so cheap. This is a real bad business idea, looking at biofuels. Just go and find something more expensive to make. And so this guy, Jake Wintermute, went through and had a look at what was really expensive to make per gram, and he came up with some really sophisticated cancer drugs that are kind of beyond the wit. And then a little further down the chart was LSD or lysergic acid. Lysergic acid basically is a precursor that's used to make actually some pretty decent drugs that are out and about there. You make about 20 tons of it around a year, and it's used to make dementia drugs and things like that, and it's hugely expensive. You need so little of it that the actual sort of amount you pay per gram is extortionate. So he decided to try and engineer yeast to produce lysergic acid as a way of just making something profitable. And he was just presenting this work, and he had a poster at a really fascinating conference that went on last week at Stanford University.
So this is what they're aiming for, Ian. How far along have they got with it?
Well, they've worked out that there's about six steps to the biological pathway that you need to drop into an organism for it to make lysergic acid. They've done two out of the six, so they're making intermediate compounds at the moment, and they're getting them out at about the level of about a gram per litre. So you have this big vegetable broth with all these yeast growing in it, and you can get out about a gram per litre.
How do you get it out?
It actually just excretes it. So the compounds are made inside the cell, and then they just pass out of the cell walls, so it goes into the mixture. Then you have to sort of work out whether I mean, your hope would be that the two are kind of immiscible, so that you can, one will actually just actually separate naturally, which does happen with some of the biofuel work. And in this case, I don't know how they're going to be sifting them out, whether they're even bothering to, because they're not particularly useful. But at the moment, it's just really proof of principle to see how far you can get down that line.
For more on all of that stuff, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science. And now, the Hanford question.
My name is Ian Roberts from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. I'm very concerned about climate change, and I'd be interested to know how we can find a sustainable source of energy to fuel our society, because I think the planet's in serious peril. And the other kind of related question I'm interested in is why green space makes us happy, because there's increasing evidence that actually people exposed to trees and plants and the natural environment are happier.
Well, green spaces might make us happy, according to Professor Ian Roberts there, but do scientists make us happy? That's a question that the Bright Club here in London is setting out to ask. The club bills itself as an experiment, so Tim Harford should be pleased about that. Can bright people, in this case academics working in and around University College London, gather together to entertain and to enlighten? I went down to their latest soiree and met up with one of the scientists getting ready to do his first ever stand-up routine.
Yes! So hello!
Hello!
Hello! Welcome to Bright Club! Yeah! Wow, so many people!
Hello, my name's Sam Tazzyman and I'm a researcher at UCL. I do research into sexual selection in evolutionary biology, studying what animals find attractive and why.
Now, you're here at a comedy event tonight and you're performing. What's that about?
That's right. Tonight I'm here to do an 8-minute comedy gig. And it's because it's for UCL, for Bright Club, which is a kind of comedy meets science event. I've been spending a while writing material and I'm hoping it's going to be funny enough.
Do you think scientists are funny?
Some of them are, yeah. I think it varies quite a lot. Like normal people, there are funny ones and less funny ones. Yeah, I'm hoping I'm one of the funny ones, at least tonight.
So your 8-minute set, how much preparation have you done?
I've prepared my 8-minute set. I was writing it for a few weeks, and then I've practiced it in front of my girlfriend a couple of times at home, and then once earlier today in a bare room in UCL in front of the other 5 performers, and then and obviously now tonight will be the night.
Can you let us in on the secret of what it's going to be about?
I can tell you that it's going to be about sperm competition, which is a field of research I'm quite interested in. It's to do with, obviously, as the name sounds, sperm. And the media's representation of a piece of research I did on that subject a couple of years ago. I got some great headlines and stuff, and I'll talk about that.
Now, just finally, how nervous are you?
I'm very nervous, I would say. I've not really ever done anything like this before. And so I've got a calm exterior, but underneath it's panic.
Is it worse than a scientific conference where they tear apart your paper?
It's very different, I'd say, actually. It's a great question. Is it worse than a scientific conference? I think it's different because, I mean, hopefully everyone tonight is there to laugh, right? Whereas at a conference, some people might be there to tear apart your paper, as you say. But on the other hand, at least at a conference, I actually know what I'm doing, whereas here I have no idea.
So yeah, hi, I'm Sam, and I work at University College London up the road, where Jenny used to work. One of the things I love about my job is the fact that I can constantly say things like reproductive tract. It's great. Loads of phrases like this. What other? Ejaculate investment. That's another good one. Seminal fluid, of course, always goes down well at parties, so to speak. Excuse me. Good, I just made that up there. Brilliant. Mating plug, that's another one of my favourites. You probably don't know what a mating plug is, and be grateful you don't. It's not a butt plug, before you say that. Be grateful you don't know what a mating plug is. What a mating plug is like a kind of biological chastity belt that the male actually applies to the female after he's finished bonking her to prevent any other males from getting in on the action and give him his sperm a good head start. And this kind of comes in 2 different ways. Sometimes you'll get like a. What will happen is after the male's ejaculated his sperm, he'll then sort of put in some kind of quick drying glue type material, some biological thing to bung up her tubes. This is actually true, honestly. No, whatever. Sometimes what they'll do instead, some species don't have this kind of glue. Instead, they'll just kind of remain in mating position, just hold there in case anything, give their sperm a chance to get a head start. And you'll see this, for example, in dogs. As any dog owners in the room might know this, when dogs are mating, doggy style, obviously. The Dog Kama Sutra is just that one page, just doggy style. So when they're mating, the male's penis actually swells up at the end and kind of gets locked into the female, so they can't actually tear apart. This happens not just to dogs, also to foxes. And if any of you like me live in an area where there are urban foxes, you'll often hear them in the winter screaming in agony as they try and tear themselves apart. So next time, next winter, when you're lying there in bed and you hear this screaming agony, you'll know that's the sound of love. But yeah, anyway, my research...
Hello, I'm Steve Cross. I'm head of public engagement at UCL and I am one of the founders of Bright Club. The idea behind Bright Club is that we get researchers of all kinds to do stand-up comedy about their work. And so some of them are scientists, some of them are humanities people, some of them are social scientists. It came about because we realised there are loads and loads of people who never hear from researchers in any way. And we tried to do a little bit of work to find out where are all the people who don't come and listen to researchers do public lectures. And they're all sorts of places, but loads of them are at stand-up comedy gigs. So we thought, well, if we get our people to do stand-up comedy gigs, then a whole load of members of the public who wouldn't normally hear them will come along and hear them.
And how often do you do it?
We do Bright Club regularly once a month at the Wilmington Arms, which is our kind of starter gig. Everyone has to play there first because it's nice and it's friendly and it's small. We then do occasional gigs that are a lot bigger. We do a lot of festival gigs. And there are Bright Clubs now starting up all over the country run by teams within those cities. So there's a Manchester Bright Club run by Mancunians for Mancunians featuring Manchester scientists.
And how easy is it to persuade scientists and other academics to get up on stage? Because it's quite daunting, right?
It is quite daunting. There are some who are very frightened. I would say it's easy to get some academics to perform because they are natural show-offs, and for them this is a new way to learn how to show off even better. I actually find it much more satisfying when there are people who say to me, no, Steve, no, I'm never going to do that. It's much too frightening. And then 6 weeks later, they're on the stage. And sometimes I would say that you can use all sorts of tricks to get them on stage. You can flatter them, you can flirt with them, you can play with their professional ego. You can encourage them, you can talk about the practical benefits of Bright Club, because no presentation you ever make will seem frightening after you've done a Bright Club. We had one man who had to spend a week in front of funding panels and was absolutely petrified. He did Bright Club and the whole of his week just seemed so easy.
This is going to be an unfair question. It's going to be like asking you to choose between your children, but who's amongst your favourites of the people you asked, academics-wise, to come along and perform and who just really knocked you out?
So one of the things we've discovered at Bright Club is that there are some departments who are really, really interested in doing Bright Club, and loads of them do it, and there are some departments where it's a lot harder. The easiest department I've ever discovered to get Bright Club performers is Scandinavian Studies. So more than 60% of the academic body of Scandinavian Studies have now performed at Bright Club. We've had people talking about Danish films, we've had people talking about Norwegian literature, we've had people talking about Viking poetry, we've had people talking about runes. You just can't stop people who know about Scandinavia coming and telling jokes about it.
What is it about science that actually you think makes good comedy? Because this is something that has come along recently. There have been uncaged monkeys, there have been big events where Brian Cox and others will talk, do science lectures, Ben Goldacre does them, in between comedy. What is it about science and those crowds that really is really kicking off right now?
I think the thing about research that lends itself to comedy is that there's content in there. There are things to make jokes about. I think if I asked researchers to stand on stage and just tell jokes, they would have no idea what to do. When I say, tell jokes about your work, find the funny side of your research, tell us stories from the weird guy that you had to work with in America when you were at that conference, and suddenly they've got something to talk about, and then they can be funny about it. So we can teach them comedy tricks for being funny about something specific, but what we can't do is just say, do jokes. Because they'll all get on stage and they would say, some, you know, aren't men different from women? And none of that stuff is funny. Whereas actually, I think there are comedy punters out there who want content in their comedy. We do a lot of evaluation of Bright Club. We follow up with the audiences and we get beautiful quotes back like, Bright Club feels like going to a proper comedy night all night, but when you ring your mum the next day, you say, oh, I was at a university thing actually, learn loads about quantum physics.
How much preparation do you give to your sort of your first timers?
With our first timers, we don't give them a lot of intensive training because we like them to find their own path. We give them a book about how to be a stand-up comic, by Logan Murray. It's a very good book. I recommend it. And we give them about an hour's briefing on basic microphone techniques and a little bit about Bright Club. And then we let them decide their own style. We let them decide their own sets. I'm totally obsessed with academic freedom, so they choose exactly what they're going to say. And the beautiful thing is, as you've seen tonight, we end up with performers who have very different styles. Some come back very witty, some come back very camp, some come back very dry. And again, we know that the audience really appreciate that. They don't get six people doing the same set with different nouns in.
But it's okay, because don't worry, he's a constructive critic. He'll, you know, gives me all this flack, but then he says at the end, find some ugly bastards and some handsome guys, have them all jerk off into cups and count sperm. Pretty fucking easy research. So I'd like to finish, ladies and gentlemen, by asking if there's any public schoolboys in the house tonight. I'll be sitting over by the bar. You can help me with my next project. So thank you very much.
Sam, how did it go?
I thought it went really well, actually. I was really pleased, yeah.
Are you still sort of shaking, nervous? What are you?
I'm now on a sort of adrenaline high, really, I'd describe it.
Now that you've described the intricate workings of sperm to an entire audience, are you going to take this on somewhere?
Well, I'd like to think that my research really does take it on further, but I sort of talk to people about sperm in the pub, just in my social life in general anyway, so I'm not sure about taking it on somewhere in a more official capacity.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Big thanks there to Steve Cross for helping us out with our recordings of the Bright Club. That's all we've got for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.